Pittsburgh makes me drunk, and then it rains. It's time for the SAFTAcast, and I'm your host, Scott C. Hey, folks, sorry, don't stone me. I'm sorry this episode's coming out a few days late. Normally, we like to have it out on the scheduled time every week, but hey, life gets in the way sometimes. One of the things was that my body decided it would play host to a thing called the human rhinovirus, so I'm gently recovering from that. Another thing was the fun and excitement of the SunTrust 2015 Fiction Writers Retreat that I have spoken of on this program. That was a grand old time with a lot of good writers, a lot of good new friends, a lot of old friends, new friends. Just a wonderful time. A lot of good writing came out of that, and everyone came away very happy with that. But if you didn't get in on that action, don't start panicking, because the 2015 SunTrust Poetry Retreat is happening this next weekend, the 12th through the 14th of June at Firefly Farms and SunTrust Academy for the Arts in Knoxville, Tennessee. This is going to be a good one, folks. The Poetry Writing Retreat. It is a combination poetry workshop led this time by poets Aaron Elizabeth Smith and Ben McClendon. They are going to be two of the poets in attendance. There will be others there to help and give their thoughts on poetry as well. And it is also a camping retreat where you come out and you can camp in the woods and learn wonderful things from wonderful people. Tickets are available for this. You can get your ticket if you want to be a part of this by jumping over to sundresspublications.com, clicking on store, and at the bottom of the page you'll see the info for it, and you can get all the details, but also know there are day passes available if you are unable to camp out the entire weekend for whatever your reason may be. You can still be a part of this for a day alone by getting a day pass, and those are also available through the Sundress store website. That is, again, sundresspublications.com. Click on store, and at the bottom of the page, click on the poetry retreat. Again, that is this coming weekend, June 12th through the 14th. You know what I love? I love it when Sundress breaks new ground. And I love it when the SAFTAcast can help promote this new ground. Former SAFTAcast guest Darren Demery has a new project through Sundress Publications coming out. It is called The Cookbook. It is going to be a video podcast, what is known as a vodcast, thrown up on YouTube, where he and a guest, a writer, will cook a recipe and then talk about literature, perhaps in the process of cooking, perhaps afterwards. I don't know what he's got cooking up his sleeves, no pun intended. Wait, how do you cook up your sleeves anyway? Is that possible? Maybe if you got a little, like, microwave in there? Bunsen burner? That's a very close. Never mind. Stop thinking the logistics. To find out about this, their first episode will be debuting very soon. By the end of the month, it will be out. You can find out about this by going to sundresscookbook.com. That is the word sundress, the word cook, C-O-O-K, the word book, B-O-O-K, as one word, .com, and finding all of the information there. You can also find them on Facebook and on Twitter. They are available. I encourage you to check this one. I'm telling you right now, I am stoked for this. I am ready for it. I am excited to see this. I'm just really jazzed up about this, and I think it'll be a grand thing. So show them your support by checking them out when it goes live very soon. Now, speaking of going live very soon, we're going to go live to an interview very soon on this program. That was a terrible segue. I apologize. I'll do better in the future. Today's guest is the one and the only Margaret Bashar. We had her on last year. We loved her so much. We said, hey, you want to come back on a second time? She said, sure. So here we are, our first return guest, Margaret Bashar. You can find her great stuff at the Hyacinth Girl Press website, as well as on Facebook and many other places. And check her book out, Stationed at the Gateway, available through SunTrust Publications. Just like the Poetry Retreat and all things, you can visit sundresspublications.com, click on the store, and you will find it in there, Stationed at the Gateway, her brand new first full collection of poetry, and it is fantastic, because Margaret is fantastic, and we had a grand old time on this program. I know you're going to love it, so sit down, get ready for it, because here it comes, right after our theme song. We'll be right back. Margaret!
Scott!
Hey, welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me back.
Well, we've wanted you back for a while now because you're awesome.
Oh, you.
Oh.
I bet you say that to all your interviewees.
So let me start this off as I usually do with the burning question that is on everyone's mind.
Uh-oh. Yes?
This is kind of appropriate. It's summertime now, technically.
Is it technically?
Yeah, technically. When you go to the beach, which do you prefer, to play in the sand or play in the water?
I like playing in the sand.
Why is that?
Because the water is scary because there are fish in it that could touch me.
I can respect that.
I'm not actually, like, if you showed me a fish, I would not be like, that is a terrifying creature. But I realized once when I was swimming in a lake, like, which, you know, intellectually, I know there are fish in that lake, but I wasn't, like, completely weirded out about it, nor did I care, like, whatsoever, until, like, I put on my little goggles and I'm swimming in the lake, and then I this fish just swims past me, and I saw it. And it wasn't a big fish. It gave no indication of having large, chompy, pointy teeth. It was just a fish, and from that moment onward, I was like, nope, nope, nope.
How old were you when that happened?
25.
It wasn't like a piranha that was after you.
No. It was just a fish. Probably had a very small mouth that it could not have opened wide enough to bite me. And it wasn't so much that I was thinking, like, this fish is going to bite me. I was thinking, like, I might touch one of these.
Have you ever owned fish? Like, as a pet?
Oh, yeah. I have had many a fish as a pet. Goldfish. By way of example, all growing up, like, I had tons of goldfish and they didn't freak me out. But I always had trouble cleaning the fish tanks because I didn't want to touch them. Like, apparently touching fish freaks me out. I don't know why.
Can you eat fish?
Well, I'm a vegetarian, so I choose not to. But
okay. Physically,
yes, I could eat a fish.
Okay. You'd have no problem if you were a meat eater consuming fish.
Right. And when I was a meat eater, I consumed fish. And honestly, on the admittedly rare occasion that I do eat meat, I've eaten fish and it doesn't, like, weird me out. I just, for some reason, touching a live fish freaks me out.
So when did you convert to vegetarianism? Was it a lifestyle choice or was it a health issue?
I was working at Girl Scout camp and it turned out that the vegetarian meals were nicer than the non-vegetarian meals. So all of a sudden, I and, like, five other girls who were working at the camp magically were vegetarians. And then, like, by the time the summer was over, I was like, oh, I think I kind of prefer this whole eating vegetarian thing. So since I was about, I guess, like, 15, I've been a vegetarian with, like, brief lapses in said vegetarianism. Like, when I was breastfeeding my son, I ate meat because I wasn't confident that I would be able to, like, get all the proper nutrients that he needed. But yeah, no, it's really, like, when I first did it over half my lifetime ago, it was 100% a selfish, I want to eat the better food move.
It started out as a selfish thing, but now it's just become your life.
I like how my body feels more when I don't eat meat. And also, like, if we have to get, like, political in some way here, I'm really against factory farming.
I think anyone with a heart is.
Well, you know, everyone says that, but then, like, you can't say you're against factory farming and then just continually eat meat that primarily comes from those kinds of places.
You know, you bring up a very good point because I really don't know where the food I get comes from. Exactly. I can't guarantee that it's not a factory farm.
Yeah. And whenever people find out I'm a vegetarian, I invariably get the like, oh, well, can I still eat meat in front of you? I'm like, you can do whatever you want. I don't care. Do your thing. I'm not going to, you know, chastise you for eating meat.
You know, it's your thing.
Yeah. You do you, person who eats meat. I don't care. At this point, it's now just sort of like I like how my body feels. And oh, it turns out it also kind of lines up with how I feel about being nice to animals.
Have you ever considered going vegan?
No, because I love cheese. Have you eaten vegan cheese? It's the worst.
No, but I have had a vegan brownie mix once.
How was that?
Vile.
See? Can't go vegan.
I needed eggs and milk in there to make the brownie right.
Right, and then therefore not vegan anymore.
Now, I'm not dumping on vegans. I'm just saying that vegan brownie mix was horrible.
Well, and also, quite honestly, like, if you don't like vegan food, being vegan would just be like torturing yourself. Like, that would be a special kind of masochism.
Use that in torture camps.
Oh, God. Like, you must eat the vegan brownie mix. That would be like a very special kind of dominatrix who is like a food dominatrix who makes people eat vegan who don't want to eat vegan.
Picture that, a food dominatrix.
That's like an episode of Portlandia waiting to happen.
But I want this egg. Which? No. Eat this rice. You worm.
That was cheese, that was tofu.
Now lick the plate clean.
Yep.
I've never been trained as a dom, so I have no idea what I
I
do.
don't think very many people have. I'm gonna come out and say that.
Where does one go for training for that? There has to be a place.
I know. You ask me like I'm going to be able to answer this question with any kind of substantial information. All right, anyone listening to this podcast, if you can know where Scott can go to get his professional dominatrix training on, email, insert the email for the Saftacast here.
I could maybe email Dan Savage as well or something, you know.
I think, I don't know. I don't know. See, I listen to a lot of Savage Love. So now I'm actually sitting here thinking, like, what would Dan Savage say in response to this?
He'd probably bring on someone like Mistress Matisse or someone.
Yeah, I follow her on Twitter. I could just tweet at her. She would probably not take kindly to that. She'd probably think I was joking, which I would only kind of be.
No, it's a genuine question, is where does one go? Because a professional dom, you have to be trained.
Oh yeah, like I mean, I can't imagine that that is something that one could do just like by the seat of their pants.
Figuratively speaking.
Or by the seat of somebody else's pants? Would that be more appropriate? I don't know.
I could learn rope knot tying from Boy Scouts, but proper safety procedures?
Internet, you can probably find like YouTube videos on that.
That's one thing I don't want to search for on YouTube.
Why not?
I have a bad feeling about that. Let's just leave it at that. There
Okay.
are some how-to videos I don't want to look up on YouTube.
See, now I feel like maybe I have a much more innocent mind than you because I have no idea why you wouldn't want to look up that how-to video. No, I'm just innocent. Don't ruin my innocence.
Okay, I won't.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
And we run the risk now of treading ground that we dealt with last year of internet pornography.
Right. Now, I was just thinking about learning how to tie sailor's knots.
Double sheepshank?
I don't know what you were thinking.
I was thinking about tying off a boat.
See that exactly. And then learning how to unfurl one's sails safely and take a voyage. Yes. I actually know nothing about boating. I'm sure there's a more official term for being on a boat and boating about, but I know so little about boating that that's where my knowledge ends. Boats. Ideally, they don't sink. A list of things Margaret knows about boats.
And they have a port and a starboard.
Do they, though? Do they?
Now we're getting into metaphysics.
That's true. That's true.
So, how have things been in the last year? I know a lot of crazy stuff has happened to you.
Yes. In the last year, hold on. Well, when we last spoke, okay, so my boyfriend moved from Milwaukee to Pittsburgh and we bought a house.
You bought a house.
I bought a house with.
Outright, or just put a down payment on a house?
Oh, God, no, I couldn't buy this thing outright. Where do you think I'm getting my sweet poetry monies from? Nowhere, that's the answer. But no, we I'm sorry. I went through the mortgage getting process, which was perhaps the literal worst thing ever that I have had to do. I mean, as much as I enjoy home ownership, I'm gonna say that if I had known how upsetting the whole process of getting a mortgage would be, I might not have done it.
What was so upsetting about it?
I hate anything that has to do with my credit score or my credit. Like, I just hate it. I don't know why, because I actually have pretty good credit. But like, when I had to go buy a car and they had to like check my credit to see if they could give me the loan for the car. Like, I almost had a heart attack. And that was like 15 minutes of my life. And then this whole getting a mortgage thing, because like they inspect every single element of your entire financial existence. And for somebody like me who has like anxiety about being seen as responsible, like, 'cause I have, for some reason, like I have huge anxieties about being seen as a responsible person. It's something that is very important to me, but that I don't necessarily feel like I deserve. I don't know why. Psychology. Let's not get into my deep, dark psychology in this.
Does it maybe have to do with the idea of being an adult?
No, I think it has to do with like having sort of felt like I was an irresponsible person when I was younger and being concerned that like as a result of like one credit card that it took me a long time to pay off, that I will never, be considered to be a responsible person ever again by those weird, mysterious numbers that are the credit score. I don't know. I hate the whole thing, and it took, I mean, and to be entirely fair, like everything with the house purchasing for us from like the moment we started looking at houses until like we closed on the house that I am sitting in currently was like 3 months. So it was ridiculously fast. Like it was ridiculously fast.
Yeah, that does sound abnormal. I would think it would be longer. How long did it take you to find the house? Like, how long were you on the hunt?
Maybe like a month and a half, maybe.
And then you just found the one.
Yeah, I mean, like it was pretty, like we were pretty sure when we went to see it, we're like, yep, we probably want this one.
What was it about the house? Was there something special about it?
And it was like just it was a it's in a cute little neighborhood, and it's got everything that we want, like everything that was on like our checklist of things we wanted, except for one thing that Dan, my boyfriend, really, really wanted, and I feel very bad about it. He's the one who cooks, I don't cook, and he really wanted a really nice kitchen. And we have somehow managed to end up with the tiniest kitchen that I've ever seen in my life. It is the weeest kitchen. So, like, our one of our projects, like, because like anybody cares about this. Does anyone care about my house buying woes?
Yes, it's interesting.
Is it?
I've never bought a house. I'm sure a number of our listeners haven't.
Well, I mean, but like my specific house buying was all right. So, listeners, Margaret's advice when buying a house: one, if you must do it, just be prepared to be questioned about everything. Like they are going to question every single thing about your financial history, everything, everything, everything. Two, don't let your like relatives start giving you large sums of money because then the bank will question that. So like the people who will come to you, like your parents or your aunts or whomever, who's like, hey, I hear you're buying a house. Here, let me give you $1,000 or whatever. Don't take it from them until after you've gotten approved on the mortgage. It will be such a ridiculous disaster. And those would be my two top pieces of advice. And then like drink a lot, probably. Because that's gonna be how you're gonna get through that. Lots of drinking and like eating your feelings. You're gonna gain weight. It's just gonna happen. Unless you're somebody who like deals with stress through exercise, but I don't believe in those people. I think anyone who says like, "Oh, I deal with my stress," like not like, "Oh, it helps me de-stress to ex like by exercising," because I'm like that too. Like I totally get that. But people who are like, "When I'm stressed out, I want to exercise." I'm like, "You're not a person. Nobody wants to exercise when they're stressed out. You want to eat a pint of custard and like drink scotch and like watch Love It or List It on Netflix. That might just be specific to me. But like in that general wheelhouse of favorite booze, favorite fattening thing, not moving.
Bad TV.
Hey, Love It or List It is quality programming.
I've never paid attention to the program, so I.
It's just some HGTV show about like about houses.
So one of those renovation type shows.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, but those would be my points of advice. My points of advice.
That's good advice. I never thought about that of the receiving gift from family and having that questioned.
Yeah, nobody thinks about that. And then all of a sudden you're getting lots of questions from the bank and you're like, why did nobody tell me about this? I mean, to be entirely fair, like the guy who was our loan officer, I think is what he was called, he actually did clue us in on that. But I know some people whose loan officers did not, and it was a big problem. So, yeah.
Oh, that's good knowledge and everything. You were telling me off the air before we got on here, you have a stage in your house.
I do. That's part of how I knew this house was the one. Because, I mean, we have no idea what the purpose of this area is, because it was an addition onto the house. So, like, the house was not originally built with this. Like, the people who owned this house before us looked at this house and were like, you know what this house needs? A stage in the dining room.
No, wait. When you say stage, what do you mean exactly for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about here?
So we have our little dining room, and then on what would be like what would have been the exterior wall of the house, like, you know, like, cause like towards the side on the side of the house, instead of just having like the wall or like a window there, they built an addition onto the side of the house, which is raised. It's raised. It's not like flush with the rest of the floor. And there's like framed like a big, almost like French doors. Like it almost looks like it'd be like French door sized. And it is like a stage on like built onto into the side of my house, but like that goes, it feeds into the living room or not the dining room.
So it's like let me see if I'm getting it right. It's kind of like a little alcove that's raised up a little bit, and it's just off the side of the dining room that goes nowhere.
Yes, that is correct entirely.
How deep is it? Is it like a walk-in closet size depth or?
The depth is like, it's not incredibly deep, but it is deep enough that like, I mean, I hate to use, I mean, like this is going to sound like a ridiculous way to describe it. It's just deep enough that realistically someone could perform burlesque on it.
I was about to ask, are we talking like puppet show deep, or are we talking Shakespearean?
We're not talking Shakespearean. We're talking like realistically someone could perform burlesque on this stage without too much of a problem.
Mental note, if I ever visit you in Pittsburgh.
Are you going to burlesque on my stage?
Either that or I'll send somebody up to do it for me, but most likely it would be me.
But yeah, no, you could. And the reason that like I thought about in those terms is because a friend of mine who does burlesque was like, we can do shows at your house. And I had to think about it. I was like, yes, you could.
I'll emcee it. I'll be the person making the corny vaudevillian jokes to introduce the performer.
I mean, like, you can fit maybe like 7 people in the dining room, so it would not be like the most well-attended burlesque show. But I'm like kind of hoping that once like we get a little bit more into the summer, and whenever, because there's a few people over the summer who are like coming out to Pittsburgh to do like readings and stuff with me, I'm kind of hoping that I'm going to do this thing where I convince people that they should like come out to Pittsburgh early, and then they can give like a little like, we can have like little like dinner parties, and people can do like little poetry readings and whatever.
Impromptu salon type of thing.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm hoping for.
You could use that space, too, during, like, October and then December or whenever. Make it into, like, a big holiday display, but only in that spot. Like, take all of your holiday decorations from around the house and put them in one spot.
So my 0 holiday decorations. Got it. So it look like it does now.
Yep.
I'll pick on holidays, weirdly. I mean, I'm going to sound like the worst mom ever, much to my child's chagrin.
Does he still go out trick-or-treating, though?
I take him out trick-or-treating every year.
You're just not big on putting up displays and doing it around the house?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I'm not just not huge into it. And, you know, if I had to pick a holiday that I was going to decorate for, it would be Halloween. Interesting you mentioned that one. But yeah, it's just not really my bag. It feels like a lot of, like, effort for something that, like, for the most part, when it comes to holidays, like, I'm not super into anyway for one reason or another. And money. Also, it's money for something that I'm not super invested in.
Unless you get things from the dollar store and such.
Yeah, but like, have you met me?
That's true.
Like, I'm a fancy lady who like overdoes everything. So I guess that's my other thing. It's like, if I start decorating for the holidays, it's going to be like a bunch of ridiculous bullshit. You know, like I am just going to go. It's either like, it's nothing or like 150 miles per hour in my world. It's like either like, okay, we're just not going to decorate for the holidays, or like you would walk into my house around Halloween and it would be just insane.
It would be like walking into a professional haunted house.
Pretty much, yes. Yes, it would be one or the other.
I can see then why you would downplay the holiday then, because that is a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And then like, where do I put it after the holiday?
Ah, that's a good point. Where do you store it all?
And I've always kind of like my guess, like my parents had an attic, so I guess they put all their stuff up in the attic. But like our attic is really, really tiny. Like really tiny, so it basically counts as not having an attic. So everything would have to go in the basement, which, you know, the basement's already got a bunch of stuff in it. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
Because you know, like when you move, you pack stuff in boxes, and then it's like, I have zero use for this thing, and I can't, so I have nowhere to put it if I unpack it, but at the same time, I don't want to throw it away.
Yeah, I don't want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. I have like 4 boxes of that stuff currently residing in my basement.
I don't know where that instinct comes from, because I constantly, every time I move, I want to jettison a whole bunch of stuff and say, okay, I'm only going to take the essentials.
Mm-hmm. But then you don't. You take boxes you don't need.
You're like, when am I ever going to use these things? I don't need them. Why can't I get rid of it?
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, Goodwill is less than a quarter mile from my house.
Yeah, and yet, here we all are with like, I mean, then I think that does really speak to, like, how ridiculous the, like, American consumerism drive is, you know? Like, we have all this stuff that we literally do not need and are just keeping in boxes because, like, it's stuff and we can't get rid of stuff. We love stuff.
Gotta have my stuff around.
Yeah, I gotta have stuff. If I don't have stuff, then what kind of American am I?
I wonder if it's just the old hoarding instinct in us.
I don't know.
To fill the cave. I don't know.
No. I mean, you would think that, like, I would know, like, I would at least be sort of aware of what it all means, because I majored in psychology in college, but a large part of the time, what people do, it's just like, you know what, it's like, you know what? I don't know, and I don't care to know.
What made you major in psychology? I don't think I've ever known that about you.
Primarily my parents telling me that they would not help me pay for college if I majored in creative writing. Like, they just, like, flat out told me, look, if you major in creative writing, because they had saved up money for me to go to college, you know? And then I just, like, I was going to college, and they were, and I was trying to decide what I wanted to major in. I was like, I want to major in creative writing. And they were like, well, you want this money, right? And I was like, I do, I do. And then they were like, well, you're not majoring in creative writing. Which, you know what, like, ha-ha and poo to them. I have used the creative writing classes that I took way more than I have used my psychology degree. Because you can basically do nothing with an undergraduate degree in psychology. But, like, here I am, like, running a poetry press. I have, like, 4 chap books and a full-length book. I run poetry readings and, like, I run a poetry event with a friend of mine that gets, like, 250 attendees. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm kind of glad that I got an education, something other than writing. But at the same time, there's a part of me that's like, that's the one I'm using. Because my like, work that I do for money is not in creative writing or in psychology. It's accounting and mathematics. So it's like completely.
You're almost like a Renaissance woman in a lot of ways then.
I guess. I don't know. Like, I guess I kind of never thought of myself that way. I do. I know a little bit about a lot of things. Does that make me a Renaissance woman? Is that what makes one a Renaissance woman? Knowing not quite enough to be professional about really anything, but knowing like, just enough to fool people about a lot of things. Nobody should listen to this interview. Ruining my street cred. Ruining it. I don't have any street cred. It's fine.
You've got a lot of street cred, actually. You
so
do.
So
you do. And I can tell you that because actually I have listener questions for you today. When I put out
a... You saw the look on my face right now. If only you saw it.
I asked a solicitor for listener questions, and you have a bit of a reputation.
Okay, so wait, hold on, real quick. So there was this one time where when I was still working in office, the one IT guy, like, who I had never really spoken to before, he came up to me, he's like, hey, I saw you on the internet, and I had this moment where I was like, what did you see? And, like, I was going through my head, I'm like, what's the worst thing of me on the internet? So that was that. So whenever someone's like, you have a bit of a reputation around, like, I'm always like, what is it? It can't be good.
Well, actually, I don't know. You know, you have a bit of a reputation on the internet, and especially in the lit community, of having essentially a give no fucks policy about things.
That would be accurate. That is an accurate reputation.
And so one of our listeners wants to know first, how you came about having that give no fucks attitude, and then part two of that, how you think that's led to your literary success.
All right, so part one, how exactly did I come to give no fucks?
Why doesn't Margaret give fucks?
Why are no fucks given? I'm trying to remember the last time I gave a fuck. Hold on. I'm having to go back in the Wayback Machine. When was the last time I gave a fuck? Last time I gave a fuck was probably when I was, okay, all right. So, all right, this is unfortunately not going to be the answer that they want. The way that I came to give no fucks, essentially, I will give it generally, and then I will give a story example, because that's how I roll. So generally, the way that I eventually came to give no fucks was people were just shitty to me, and my choices were that I could cry about it all day, or I could not care. And you know how they say, like, fake it till you make it?
Yeah.
I have made it. I was like, well, I just can't care. People are going to be shitty to me. They're not going to be nice to me sometimes. I will not care. And then I just sort of convinced myself, you know, just I'm like, okay, I'm just not going to care. If someone says something shitty to me or about me, or like if somebody tries to tell me not to do something in the literary world or in the arts, I will not really concern myself with their opinion. As long as I'm not hurting anyone and I'm doing something that brings me fulfillment or happiness as an artist. And it's honestly, okay, so I'm going to use my psychology degree right now. It's a form of cognitive therapy.
Okay.
Where like you use your actual cognitions, your thoughts to then affect your behavior and your emotions. And so, and I think everybody feels like, I will say, I don't think there's anybody in the literary world who does not feel this way sometimes. I will say that. I want to go on record before I tell any story of saying that I think that everyone in the literary world and in the arts world and probably in the world, sometimes feels the way that I am about to describe. And that's why I think that a give no fucks attitude could be helpful for us all. So when I was an undergrad, I had this professor who was like the only creative writing professor at the college that I went to. And
what college was that?
I went to Carlo University.
Okay.
But back before their current creative writing staff was in place, it was a different staff at the time.
Okay.
One person of like one individual. And he was, I will say, he was a very, very good teacher. Like, I would not be as good of a poet as I am were it not for him. He was a very good teacher in terms of, like, teaching. And, like, he was really good at teaching his students to how to become better poets without trying to make us all sound like him or without telling us, like, we need to do it the way he did it. Like, he was really, really amazingly good at that. The one thing he was not quite as good at was, like, not making it ridiculously obvious who his favorite students were. And while I will admit that I was like one of his more favored students, like there was always this sort of sense of like everyone's kind of like competing to be like the most favorite. But I got my first few publications, my first few acceptances while I was still an undergraduate. Like, and like in really good journals too. Like my first like official poetry acceptance was to Cake Train. Thank you. At the time, like, all I knew was, like, I really liked what they had published, and I thought that, like, I could fit here, you know, because, like, I read a couple of their issues. I was like, I really like what they're doing, and so I was like, I should submit to them, you know? And the funny thing is that if, like, I had known that they were kind of a big deal, I would perhaps not have submitted to them. But, like, at the time, I was like, I really like these guys. So I submitted to them. It was my, and I was very, very proud of myself. But, like, and, you know, like, as you do when you're, like, 20, 21 years old and you get your first poetry acceptance and you're still, like, an undergrad and, you know, you have this professor who you're trying to impress and these, and, like, and in my, like, youthful ignorance, I also thought that my classmates would be happy for me. And so, like, I go to my professor, and I'm all happy, and I'm like, I just got an acceptance to Cake Train, you know? And I told a couple of my classmates, and I think that they all just thought that I was, like, such a bragger, and, like, nobody congratulated me. And even my professor, rather than congratulating me, gave me a lecture about how the actual joy of writing is in writing, and that... And, like, the actual metaphor he used was, like, sex. And he was, like, writing is the true orgasm. And publication is the morning after where you're looking for your socks. And I was like, now I'm kind of sad. Because like here's me, like I'm super proud of my first acceptance ever. And like everyone just kind of like, eh. But like for some reason, I was like, no, I'm allowed to be excited about this. And I was really upset about it at first. Like I was really upset.
So that's kind of the start where you start getting this give no fucks attitude.
Yeah. Cause I was like, wait, I was like, okay, so this is something that I'm excited about. That I'm pleased about. I really like this journal. I get to be in this journal. I get to be part of this. I'm really happy about this. I'm really excited about this. And I've always enjoyed like publishing and editing and publishing other people's work and whatever. And for me, I was like, this is something that is exciting for me. And so I was like, you know what? If other people are either gonna just like not care or they're gonna kind of be nasty to me about it, whatever. I don't give a fuck.
So now the second part of the question then, how is this how has this led you to the literary success that you have?
Well, the less I give a fuck, the less that stuff really like affects me and like stops me from doing things. I think it's also helpful, honestly, that I'm not within like academia. Like there's very little like restriction on me in terms of like what I can do as a poet and as an editor and as an artist in general. Like there's so little restriction on me because like I don't have anyone to answer to really except for myself. And I'm not concerned about like I don't have to publish in particular types of journals, you know. I mean, because I know that people who like want to get jobs, the English creative writing academia, whatever, like I know there are certain places that they want to publish more so than others. That's the case for a lot of people. I just don't really care. I just publish places that I like because I'm not really, I'm just worried about like doing what I want. It turns out that my mom, like many years ago when I was sad because the other kids picked on me, she was like, Margaret, you just be yourself. And then, you know, if you just continue to be yourself, you know, people will see that and respect that. And I was like, no, they won't. Yes, they will.
So as time has gone on, that's how you've built your rep base. And is
Yeah.
that, I don't give a fuck.
Yeah. And then like, and by then writing the things that I want to write and publishing the things I want to publish and doing the things that I want to do. And the other thing is like, I take a genuine joy in doing those things. And I think that's part of it too, is like, some people are totally miserable in the whole like submitting and writing and attempting to publish. Like it makes people miserable. And I think legitimately so, because it's like it beats you down. Like, but I just take a genuine joy in everything that I do. If something in writing or in like the art world is not giving me joy, I don't do it. And I think that, I mean, I suspect that my actual genuine excitement and joy at the things that I do comes across.
Are there groups out there that counteract that? Because for our listeners who don't know, we're seemingly like we're painting a picture here that the lit communities are very competitive, and that's a given. They are.
They are.
But are there communities out there that are not as abusive? I mean, are there communities out there that support one another?
Well, I mean, I don't think that I said, nor would I say, that every lit community is, quote, abusive, unquote.
No.
I think that in particular, when you're first starting out, I think people can be jealous, and I think that's natural and normal. And I mean, I felt jealousy in my life, you know, I felt jealousy in my time in the literary world. I think it's impossible not to. I do think that there are literary communities that are genuinely supportive of the people within them. But I think that we are all people. And I think we're all human and we're all therefore imperfect and we're going to treat each other imperfectly and we're going to treat ourselves imperfectly. And so when I say that like it beats you down, I don't mean the people around you beat you down. I mean that like getting rejections beats you down and that like the search for that community that you speak of can also be sort of trying because sometimes like it's hard to find that community. I think when you do find it, it's a really great thing. I really, really do. But I will say that I think that it's important to have like the internal strength to also be able to deal with most of it on your own. I think that's very important. And I think that we all have that. I think we can all have that. I don't say that like, and if you don't have that, then you shouldn't be doing this. No, I think that we all can have that, and we all do have that capacity within us. And sometimes through those communities, helping to foster that strength and that ability to handle those kinds of things within ourselves.
So it's important to be self-reliant, but also to know when to be able to reach out and have a kind of, not a safety net, but a network that you can go to and be like, hey, yeah, I got an issue here.
I would say that. Yeah. I think that's really important. And I also think that, like, also in particular, when people are like just starting out, it's hard to find that, you know, because when you're just starting out and you're like fresh into the whole literary scene, chances are that most of the people around you are also starting out. And it can be difficult. And I don't know. I don't know if I have a necessarily like an answer for like how do you find that community. I honestly don't know if I have an answer for that. I wish I did. I would like to think that there is a group of people out there for pretty much everybody, you know? Like, as long as you're not being a dick, you know, as long as you're not being a dick, there's probably a group of people out there who would like you to be a part of it, who are gonna be kind, good, supportive human beings.
That sounds like the best advice for anyone just starting out in their literary career, be they undergrad or non-traditional or whatever. Just don't be a dick.
Oh, yeah. No, it's real good advice. Also, celebrate your own successes and the successes of the people around you. And don't celebrate one at the expense of the other. And if somebody else is doing like really, really awesome, like if one of your friends is like all of a sudden like the successful one, it's gonna be hard. Believe me, I know that too. It's gonna be hard. But I don't know, don't be a dick. I wonder why that's so hard for people.
Yeah, I just don't understand why. I
Yeah.
just want to celebrate my friend's good work, or if they're really hot in the lit community, I just want to be like, there's a reason why you're really hot right now in the lit community, because this shit is awesome.
Or honestly, I mean, you don't even have to think the shit is awesome. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, there are some people who I think are like really lovely human beings. I don't particularly care for their writing. That doesn't mean that I don't still support them and celebrate them. And that's the other thing. Like, I think sometimes people sort of lump together like this person, I like this person's writing, therefore they must be a good, nice person and my friend, or like I don't like this person's writing, and therefore like we can't be friends. And like those things are totally untrue. Those are both completely untrue statements.
It's like the work and the person are separate.
Yeah, and you don't have to like what all your friends are doing. That's fine. Like you can be friends with people whose poetry you don't like, but then like don't be like, eh, I don't know why that got published, you know, if it does get published, because different people have different tastes. And some editor's gonna love something that you don't necessarily like. I don't know. I just think that people should be nicer.
I agree.
And you would think that like that attitude and the attitude of give no fucks would not necessarily go well together, because people have asked me that. They've been like, well, but like you say you give no fucks, but then you tell people to be nice to people. I'm like, if you think that giving no fucks and being nice to people don't go together, I don't know what to tell you. You are not the student for me. Like, giving no fucks is about getting away from, or at least being able to let roll off your back, negativity and naysaying. It's not about ignoring good, joyful things, and it's not about being a jerk.
Mixing our swear words, giving no fucks means taking no shit.
Yeah, it's that. It's that. It's really giving, yeah, that means taking no shit, but also not freaking out about it. You know, like giving no fucks also means not like then proceeding to just like flip your shit about people, like, well, I don't care about this, but now you're gonna listen to me rant about it for 45 minutes. You know, like if you actually give no fucks, you let things go.
I agree. Well, let me return to listener questions now. And actually build on that one through Hyacinth Girl Press now, which is the one that you run.
I sure do.
And you have a very unique style when it comes to your chapbooks that you put out. So one of our listeners wants to know, where did you come up with the idea for using a ribbon as your binding?
I stole it from Juliet Cook, who runs Blood Pudding Press.
I'm sure she will be honored to hear that. Have you told her
Well,
that?
she taught me how to do it. Yeah. I mean, she does the Blood Pudding Press chapbooks for anyone who is not familiar with them. Juliet binds them with like all these like really fancy yarns. Basically, she uses yarn. And she was like, and she, I think she actually offered. She said, "Do you want me to show you how to do this?" And I was like, "Yes." And it's like a really simple like three-hole method of ribbon or yarn or saddle binding essentially that she showed me in about like 15 minutes one time when I was visiting her out in Ohio. So she's well aware. She's well aware. That I swiped it from her. Like the big differences between how I bind for Hyacinth Girl and how she does her binding for Blood Pudding is that Juliet tends to use like a number of different types of yarn, and like she uses these very fancy yarns and materials to bind the chapbooks for Blood Pudding, whereas I go for a little bit more of like a uniform look with Hyacinth Girl Press. Like if you have all of my chapbooks on your shelf, they all do look like they belong in like the same family, but like in a very sort of like neat uniform way, because I'm a little bit OCD. I measure very carefully where all the binding goes. Like it's very like very precise. We'll call me precise.
Let's return to Holmes for a moment here,
Okay.
because we have another listener question about this one. Or kind of, I'm gonna lump it in with the house thing.
Okay, that's fine.
You and I can both say that houses cost money.
Yes.
No, the mortgage is only the beginning.
Yeah.
In the words of Richard Pryor, everything costs $500. Doesn't matter what it is.
Okay, sure. We'll go with that. We'll go with that as a number, sure.
But I'm assuming that you're doing some home improvement projects with this house.
Yeah, we are.
Okay. Which is your preferred store? Lowe's, Home Depot, or Ace?
It depends on what I'm buying. Is this actually a listener question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It depends on what I'm buying, because I have been to Lowe's and Home Depot enough in the past 2 months that I know what costs more at Home Depot and what costs more at Lowe's and which store has a better selection of what. So it really depends on what I'm looking to purchase. But like right now, a large part of what I'm doing is like I'm doing some landscaping stuff, planting bushes, ripping out bushes, things like that. And anything that has flowers already on it, don't trust Lowe's or Home Depot because they spray paint the flowers.
They what?
They spray paint the flowers. Particularly on cacti, don't buy cacti from those stores, because like the flowers that you see on those cacti often are not even actually growing from those cacti. They're often glued on. I'm not kidding.
Well then, I think you just blew the lid off the home improvement cactus industry.
Well, no, people are still just buying them. It's fine. But like that's why they're so like if you go to those stores and you see the cacti, why they're so like the flowers are so falls out ridiculous colors.
I
Yeah.
never thought about this.
That's and they all look the same. If you also look like all the flowers look the same. I looked at it the last time I was there. Not because I would ever buy a cactus for Pennsylvania, but I had heard this from somebody a friend of mine who raises cactus. And so I was like, all right, I'm gonna look at this. He might just be full of crap. This might be like his little hippy dippy story to get me to buy a cactus from him or something. I don't know. But no, they're all the flowers look exactly the same, and they are like just crazy ridiculous colors. And it's not because that's the natural color of cactus flowers in nature.
I am going to do this next time I'm at Home Depot or a similar store. I'm just going to look at the I'm going to look at their flowers. I'm going to look at the cactuses if they have them.
And it's always it's the exact same flowers, no matter what kind of cactus it is.
Yeah, I've got nothing to that.
It's a case by case basis on what I'm going out to purchase, and like most of it doesn't really make a difference. I mean, I would normally just say the one I live closest to, but I live equidistant to a Lowe's and a Home Depot. And to be entirely fair, I've only been to an Ace Hardware once, and they screwed up the keys that I was getting a copy of the keys made, and they screwed them up, so not Ace.
We'll throw them right out then. Yeah.
Under the bus they go.
Pew, gone. Take that, John Madden.
Okay.
We used to promote them. So anyway, stupid pop culture knowledge. Okay, so I have another question for you then from actually a former guest on this program.
Okay, from who?
I will not say. I'll tell you off here. You know,
Oh, okay. Well,
because
so I
I.
don't really know who's asking these questions.
Exactly, you know. I just want
That's
to throw
fine.
these at you, make you guess.
That's fine.
One thing I know I can probably get you talking about here. I'll do this in two parts. The first one, they want to know about two things, your opinions on. So I'll get your opinions first on this. What is your opinion and thoughts on Ferris wheels?
I mean, I'm not afraid of heights or anything, so not scary. Am I in the Ferris wheel with someone I want to make out with?
No knowledge of that.
All right, so if I'm in the Ferris wheel, like in the little like cart thing with someone who I would like to make out with, positive feelings about Ferris wheels. If I'm in the Ferris wheel and it's just me, unless there is a very picturesque landscape around me, kind of bored.
Yeah, I'd be right in line with you on that. Though I've actually never made out with someone in a Ferris wheel.
You know, I don't think I have either. I just like making out.
I got no problems with that, honestly. I don't know if anyone actually does make out on Ferris wheels. I think it's just a movie cliche.
Well, then I don't like Ferris wheels at all because they've lied to me in movies.
I only like one Ferris wheel, and it's the one in London because you can actually see something interesting when you're going around it.
There's one in Vegas that like probably costs way too much money to be on, but like in the little Ferris wheel pods, they also have bars. And I would not necessarily be against that Ferris wheel, except it probably costs a ton of money to get onto it.
Yeah, probably.
I like Vegas though, in general.
I've never been there.
Dan took me for the first time this past Christmas, and I quite enjoyed myself.
What were some of the most interesting things there? Well, if you could pick one highlight of Vegas.
Wedding chapel. Go to the Denny's at the wedding chapel. In Old Vegas, there's a Denny's that has a wedding chapel in it. So we went to that, and they serve booze at the Denny's. So we went to the Denny's, and we watched this sweet elderly couple have their vows renewed by Elvis, and we drank scotch.
In a Denny's.
In a Denny's. And if we looked out the window, we could see the cowboy, the light up cowboy.
Okay, so if I go to Vegas, which I'm aiming, my wife and I have joked that that's what we're going to do for our 10th anniversary.
Okay.
That's what we're going to do is go to Vegas for a weekend, have our vows renewed by the Rocky Horror Wedding Chapel, or possibly in the Star Trek bar if it still exists.
Okay.
So we'll make a note then, Denny's and the Wedding Chapel.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's pretty great. And then we got to be part of their champagne toast. That was pretty great too.
It was just a champagne toast for the married couple, the elderly people.
Yeah.
I'm trying. I worked in a Denny's in college. I just can't picture. Just can't picture
Beautiful. It was so beautiful.
So Ferris wheels. Okay. So the other question, you are known for having awesome pairs of shoes.
I would love to know how this connects to Ferris wheels. Go on.
They just want to know, what are your thoughts about shoes? They were nondescriptive about this, unspecific.
What are my thoughts on shoes? Well, if you ask my boyfriend, he would probably tell you I borderline have a shoe fetish. So I really like shoes. Basically, the higher the heel, the happier I probably am. I have a friend who taught me how to walk in high heels, and I think it's fun, honestly, as long as you know how to walk in them. From my experience, my personal experience of shoes, of which I prefer heels, has been that as long as you know how to walk in them and you're smart about it and you don't and you get shoes that don't suck, at the end of the day, your feet don't hurt. I think that really pretty shoes are. I'm so girly, like I'm so ridiculously girly. I'm one of the girliest people I have ever met. I'm totally unashamed of that. And because, you know, definitely one of those feminists who feels like I can be ridiculously girly and feminine, and as long as I don't feel like that's how everybody needs to be. I don't even really choose to be super girly. I just am.
It makes you happy.
It does. It does. I don't know. I love shoes. My thoughts on shoes are, I would like some now, please.
Do you have a favorite pair right now?
Oh man. Well,
I should specify actually, because that's kind of a vague
that's
question there. Do you have a favorite special pair of shoes that you don't necessarily wear every day?
okay. That's a good question.
Because I have my favorite pair of shoes are the comfortable ones I wear every day.
I mean, I have this really okay. I do have a pair of shoes that I really super love. I like if I was told I could only keep one pair of my heels, they're the ones I would keep. I have this really cute pair of heels that actually part of why I like them so much is because, like, I'm also very lucky in that my boyfriend is totally okay with my shoe related issues. And so, like, whenever he was still living in Milwaukee, sometimes he would just send me like links to shoes that he knew that I would like. And one time, like right before AWP Seattle, he sent me a link to a pair of heels. They are these like 5.5 inch heel, like with like a 1 inch platform pumps, and they have like little like they're black with like little white polka dots, like actually stitched onto them. It's not like printed onto the fabric. They're actually stitched on. Important point. With like a night with a bright red ankle strap that's in like a shiny, it's like patent leather. And then like the heel itself is like red patent leather, and then the platform is red patent leather, and they are so cute.
I'm trying to imagine these right now, and I think whatever I come up with in my head will not be nearly as awesome as they actually are.
I will tell you, there are pictures of them on Facebook. So if you want to see them, I've posted pictures of them on my Facebook. Depending, listeners, on how devoted you are to looking at pairs of high-heeled shoes, I'm personally pretty devoted. Yeah, there are pictures on my Facebook.
You might have to send me one so I can truly, because I may have seen them when you originally posted them, but so much happens on the internet in even just 2 days.
Like over a year ago, and I don't expect really anyone, even me, to remember what I did on the internet a year ago.
Well, like if you could design a shoe, what would you do? What would be the Margaret?
God, like, well, first I'd have to go to some sort of like design class, because I've never actually done any like fashion design type stuff. I don't know. I mean, like, if you ask like what I generally look for in a shoe,
Well, then let me ask that question. What do you generally look for in a shoe?
are we like soliciting people to buy me shoes now? Is this where this conversation is going?
I don't know.
Like to buy me shoes.
If you would like to buy Margaret shoes.
I like really high heels because, I mean, I've found that because when walking in heels, for a number of reasons, like aesthetically, I like how they look, but also in terms of for balance, like I find like kitten heels and those kind of little short heels, I actually find those very unbalancing because the way that I personally walk in heels, the way I was taught to walk in heels, is that you have to actually shift your center of gravity. And it's easier for me to like really pitch my center of gravity forward, if that makes sense. Rather than like if you only have like a 1 or like 1.5 to 2 inch heel, then it's much more difficult for me personally to place my center of gravity properly. So something with like a closer to like a 5.5 or 6 inch heel, I'm much more able to just like pitch my center of gravity farther forward. It actually makes it easier for me to walk in them. So when people tell me they're like, oh, well, I can only wear like really low heels because those are easier to walk in, that is not an experience that I share. So also just like aesthetically, I like them more. So probably like 5.5 to 6 inches. Depending on if I have a pedicure or not today, and I don't. So normally I would say probably peep toes. However, that said, I have just looked at my own foot, not peep toe.
Not today.
More of like a rounded toe, or like if it's a point, like I don't really like those really long points at the tips of shoes, if that makes sense. Because have you seen those? I mean, like I'm asking a dude, so I understand that the answer to that might be
No, the
no.
answer might surprise you. I was recently buying dress shoes.
Okay.
And something I've noticed about dress shoes, at least for men right now, is there is a trend in the square toes in creating the block square toe ends.
Right.
And I hate that look on me. I always feel like I'm wearing clown feet.
Right, because they have they're like these really long toes, and then they square them off. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Because I've seen those, and I think those like I'm like, how would you even walk in that?
For me, at least, I want my shoe to look like a shoe, if that makes
Yeah, and
sense.
I would like it to be like similar in size to my foot. And so those like ladies' heels were like they have this really long pointed toe. I don't particularly care for those. So I like something that like if it's gonna be pointed, it's still like I want it to be like closer to the actual like tip of my foot, like a rounded or like slightly pointed toe. Not that like crazy craziness. I don't even know what that is. It also to me like I mean maybe it's a sort of like a like what's in style now kind of thing. But those always kind of look like middle-aged lady shoes. But at the same time, I see a lot of women my age wear them, so I don't think it's actually a middle-aged lady shoe. I think I just don't like it. So yeah, like more of a rounded toe or slightly pointed, but not the long point. 5.5 to 6 inch heel with a little bit of a platform. I kind of like the ankle strap. I don't necessarily usually care for other straps on my shoes, but like I do like a nice ankle strap sometimes.
You definitely know your shoes, I will say that.
Well, because it's like, how some people really like, I don't know, what do other people like? I like shoes. Yeah,
It's your thing. Everybody's got a thing or two that they really dig.
some people are very particular about about their shirts and how their shirts fit, and some people are very, very particular about things that like how they fit on their body or with their body, or some people are very, very particular about I was trying to think of things that I'm not particular about, and I'm just a very particular person. For somebody who gives no fucks, I'm awfully hard to please.
No, I know what you're talking about. Yesterday, actually, I was looking for a new pair of jeans. And jeans are one of two items of clothing that I'm very particular about.
Oh, jeans! I used to hate shopping for jeans. I literally like I own two pairs of pants now because I can't stand pants.
See, I love denim. I wish that I could be burned when I'm cremated, that I could be burned with the denim on.
Why don't you? What you know? You can put that in your will.
Unfortunately, I found that due to state laws, as I understand it, no, the body has to be not clothed. At least as I understand it. Now, I could be wrong, and listeners, if I am wrong,
Please
please
let him know.
help us out of here. Because I know, for example, in New York State, it is illegal to send a body across, a lake, let's say, on a burning raft, like Vikings. That's illegal because it's an environmental concern, which saddens me.
That sends me as well. I used to joke that I wanted a sky burial, which meant I wanted to be fed to vultures. I'm sure there are laws against that too.
Probably you just can't dump bodies in the street like you used to.
That's so true. I didn't want to be dumped in the street. I wanted to be fed to vultures. Totally different.
The good old days.
The good old days when you could chop up a body and feed it to some vultures.
Exactly. Or just throw it to the pigs.
Oh, poor pigs.
Wow. I don't know where to go with that one.
Well, are there any more questions
Actually, no, but
that
I
I
will.
can?
One thing I love talking to you about, Margaret, one thing I love about our chats is that you do have the tendency to make me shut up.
Do
Because I don't know where to go with something sometimes.
I?
I just have to kind of pause and go, where were we talking about?
Well, here's the thing. I think that both you and I are people who we're used to being the person who has the most outlandish thing to say. And so I've noticed that we kind of run into this every so often with each other. We're like, one of us will say something thinking like, ah, yes, I just said the outlandish thing. And then the other person will come back and like without missing a beat and not trying to, will then say something somehow more ridiculous. And then the first person who wasn't even, I don't think was even consciously thinking, I just said the weird thing. It's just like, okay.
It's like meeting an equal, but we're not trying to best each other.
Right.
It's
Yeah,
not
we're
a
not actually
not.
attempting to one-up each other. Like, I legitimately did want to have my corpse fed to vultures at one point.
I don't know. I've never wanted to be fed to vultures, though I will say that vultures I have a weird connection to, in
Okay.
that I was once told by an ex that if you see vultures when you're going on a trip, it's a sign of good luck. It's a sign of good travel. Supposedly, it dates back to Romulus and Remus and the founding of Rome and seeing vultures in the sky. So, every time I go on a vacation now, one of the things I'm always looking for on the drive to the airport or just driving is vultures in the sky. If I see them, I know I'm good.
Well, but then now, if you see them, you're gonna think, I wonder if they just ate a person.
That's true. Now I will. What roadkill have you found? Was it quadrupedal or bipedal?
Exactly. Well, and
Exactly.
I guess like in my head, part of it was I was like, well, that would be environmentally more friendly, right?
That would be.
Wouldn't it? I don't even know. Now someone's gonna be like, no, it wouldn't, and it would kill a vulture, you horrible person.
It depends on what bloodborne diseases maybe you had at the time of death or how
Yeah.
you died.
Probably all of them.
Well, Margaret, we are almost out of time. It just flew by.
Sure did. It sure did. Wow, yeah, that's
But before we go, what have you got out right now? Your book just came out, what, last month?
Yeah, well, my first full-length book, Stationed Near the Gateway, came out from Sundress Publications in April. And then, well, that was at the beginning of April, like at AWP. And then at the end of April, I wrote a collaborative chat book with Lauren Eggert Crow called Rungs, and that came out from Grey Book Press at the end of April. And it's not available yet, but I actually just had a chat book accepted for publication by Saucepot Publishing. So I don't know when precisely that's coming out, but probably not for a while, I would imagine. I mean, I'm kind of honestly like sort of like hoping not for a little while because I just asked people to buy two books.
That's okay though. Keep us posted when that does come out from Saucepot, and we'll put up a link to it.
Yay.
That is awesome. Well, where can the where before we go, where can the folks find you online?
I mean, probably the best place to find me online is honestly just the Hyacinth Girl Press website. I need to get a personal website. That would probably be smart. I should do that at some point. But right now, the best place to see what I'm up to is either like on Facebook or the Hyacinth Girl Press website, which is just hyacinthgirlpress.com. And I'm pretty excited because we're going to be doing some new stuff on the website. We're going to start posting reviews of books and chapbooks from other presses that we really admire. And I have a reviews editor, Sarah Boyle, who's going to be in charge of all that. That's exciting. Yay.
So big things happen in HGP.
I mean, I'm kicking around the idea of doing a shortened reading period next year and then soliciting one or two of my poets I've already published chapbooks by and doing a full length from one of them.
Good idea to kick around.
It is. I think it would be interesting. And then if it turns out I hate it, I just do it once, you know?
Yeah, it might be worth looking into, might not, but you won't know until you try.
Yeah, pretty much. And then it's also a matter of like, it's got to be someone, you know, who I really love working with, and who also happens to have a book.
And on that note, we'll end it. Margaret, thank you for being on the program again.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was super duper fun.
It's awesome to have you and awesome to talk with you, and we'll chat with you soon.
Yes, and like hopefully soon we can chat in like non-official ways. Like you could come to Pittsburgh or something. We can like just be people.
I really
Be
have to get
people.
back. Yeah, I really have to get up to Pittsburgh one of these days. I miss it. It's been many years since I've been up there.
Well, you should fix that, darn it.
Until then.
All right, until then.
Take care.
All right, you as well. Farewell for now.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.